You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has proposed an 8-minute and 46-second period of silence at 5 p.m. today, Monday, in memory of George Floyd and in determination to end police violence. Well, we don't do silence well on the radio, so instead we're starting with a spirited version of Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem. Originally written as a poem by James Weldon Johnson and later set to music by his brother, John Rosamond Johnson. This is the We Are the Future Big Band.
Here we go.
Ooh.
Let me hear you say,
yes, we are. Yes,
come
we
on,
are.
Say
we.
Tell everybody that you know, let me hear you say we. You too.
Yes, we are.
Say we. We are going to see the king. Soon and very soon,
soon and very
we are going to see the king. And I wish I knew how to do it, feel to be free. Soon and very soon, we are going. Let us march on till victory. Let us march on till victory.
This is State House Watch on WNHNLP 94.7 FM and streaming at WNHNFM.org. I'm Arnie Alpert.
I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're here with you from the American Friends Service Committee. This radio program is a companion piece to our weekly State House Watch newsletter. We come to you live on the radio at 5 p.m. on Mondays and rebroadcast again Tuesday mornings at 8 a.m. We had a busy week, including major protests against the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis and systemic police violence against the Black community.
That's right, Maggie. And we've also still got a pandemic going on. On Friday, Governor Sununu announced continued reopenings of beaches and businesses.
And this coming Thursday, the New Hampshire House will return to action for an unusual session in a hockey arena. We'll be discussing that with Jeannie Ruska from the ACLU.
Let's start with a speech delivered by our colleague, Martin Toe, at the Black Lives Matter rally in Concord on Saturday.
I want to start out with this. A person asked me, he said, you know, where does racism come from? I said this, I said, man, my people have been through a lot. The Europeans went into Africa, and when it came there, they took all the gold. They put us on boats and brought us to the native land. They took us from our mother's land. And when they brought us here, they didn't give us no coats in this cold world. They sold us as slaves. I said, man, my people have been through a lot. When they said we were free, funny, right? They said, you're free, but don't come close to me. My people have been through a lot. When we started to march for peace, they threw rocks at us and brought doves to us to bite us. They didn't want us to be united, they only wanted to divide us. My people have been through a lot. I heard some man say, Martin, I would love to join you at the march, but I'm afraid of looting. Man, come on, bro. You don't understand. You don't understand that you've been looted. You've been, your old bosses have been looting your wages. Wage. The police and the prison system, they've been looting young African Americans and minority groups and spreading them into jail. I told them, you want to know about looting? I'm going to tell you about looting. How about the financial institutions taking all the wealth in this country and putting it against people to fight war? What about us? One man said, Martin, I know you have a dream. I said, yes, I do. I have a dream. I was anointed by you for angel, and I was destined for this time. And here we are all together. We were destined for this time. Yeah. Under the mantle of Dr. King, when he said on the hills of New Hampshire, and I want to say in the streets of New Hampshire, let justice reign. Yeah. In the streets of New York, let justice reign. Listen, I have a vision, and it's very clear. I see a new Boston Tea Party, and in the streets of Boston, let justice reign. I love this quote that says, united we fall, united we stand, divided we fall. When you see your brother on the ground, you better pick up the call. You better pick up your phone. You better put them on glass, because every life in this place right here should be looking at us, particularly because we are being misused and abused, and we're being mistreated. We've been in this place for so long, we haven't got our rights yet. Come on! And I'm a Christian, but I want to say to the church, you have been looting the peace of the world. You have been looting the peace of the world. When you see violence in the streets, and the pastor is quiet, you are looting the peace of the world. So why is this LGBTQ? So why is this Nepalese? So why is this other races? So why is this Mexican? So why is this African? We're all supposed to work together and love each other and make this world much better. Let's go!
Those are powerful words. I know I was inspired listening to them, and just to see Martin's leadership among other members of Change for Concord as they stood beside these high school students and helped them to feel the power of their own voices.
It was a very powerful rally, Meg. We had, 1,000 or well over 1,000 people, a lot of young people, and it was organized by high school students with support from people who were really just a couple years out of high school. So it gives me hope for the future, and there's a real spirit there. And you know, it made me think about a poem that years ago had been written by Langston Hughes called Let America Be America Again. So let's listen to that, recited by Charles Balfour.
Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, and any man be crushed and one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro servant to you all. I am the people humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today despite the dream, beaten yet today. Oh, pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet I am the one who dreamt a basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sinks in every brick and stone, in every furrowed turn. That's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland free. The free? Who set the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay. For all the dreams we've dreamed, and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung. The millions who have nothing for our pay, except a dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet, and yet must be. The land where every man is free. The land that's mine. The poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me. Who made America. Whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stay. From those who live like leeches of people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes. I say it plain. America was never America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains and the endless plain. All the stretch of these great green states, and make America again.
That was Charles Balfour reciting a poem by Langston Hughes written in 1935. There's a timelessness to these urgent calls to think deeply and to do better as a society. Let's shift to the other crisis, the pandemic. Arnie, what's the latest from the state's reaction?
Well, interesting, Maggie. On Friday, Governor Sununu announced a step forward for his Main Street business bailout plan. He said that businesses, thousands of businesses which had applied to be part of this, were going to be getting messages soon from the state. Here's a clip from his news conference.
The Main Street Relief Fund, huge program. I mean, really successful so far in that we had a two-week pre-grant application process where we received just over 13,000 submissions and pre-grant applications, pre-qualification applications, I should say. From that, we used some of the initial data that was gathered to generate a formula that we can talk about. And today, this afternoon, those folks that submitted that pre-grant qualification, because you had to do that to be part of the program, will all be receiving an email this afternoon that will walk them through individually the final grant submission process that will allow them to verify the information that they've given and again, click send. And this is really for those Main Street businesses that have really been affected by COVID. So again, if you've submitted your application, keep an eye out for it in the, I guess, this afternoon.
So Maggie, that program appears to be moving forward from a vaguely defined promise to one that will benefit thousands of local businesses, although it's not clear right now exactly which ones, and we'll want to keep an eye on whether some businesses are being left out.
This all is going forward, but still without pre-approvals from legislators who normally oversee state spending. Also on Friday, Judge David Anderson said he would allow legislators to present arguments about their authority, but refused to halt the governor from going forward spending federal CARES Act funds. Arnie, what else was on the governor's mind?
Well, Maggie, he announced the reopening of beaches. He also talked about other outdoor attractions. He talked about golf courses, summer camps, weddings, and restaurants. Here are some highlights.
Beaches. As many folks may know, this morning we made an announcement after looking at the data, looking at models in other states, what had happened, looking at what had gone on in our own state, the fact that people had been keeping the distancing and there weren't any signs of any significant outbreaks anywhere in the country, really, anything of significance in terms of beach activity. The decision was made to effective immediately go to and allow more traditional beach activities, whether it be sunbathing, things of that nature. We're still asking folks to keep a minimum distance of 6 feet on the beach. Make sure you have that physical distancing between yourself and maybe your family or other parties that are on the beach. Parking are still going to be limited, and we're expanding the activities that are currently covered under the outdoor recreational attractions guidance, which is already in place for some attractions, but we're going to include things like batting cages, rope courses, disc golf, caves, petting zoos, and some other outdoor recreational activities. For a full list of everything that we're moving forward with, please visit nh.gov under the Stay at Home 2.0 button so you can get a full list of any additional activities there. Also, restaurants. A lot of folks know that we took the step to open outdoor dining approximately 2 or 3 weeks ago. And while many restaurants continue to operate with takeout and delivery, we're going to take another step, and we're doing this one a little differently in that we're taking this in a geographic approach. So beginning on June 15th, so that's about 9 days from now, we want to give restaurants time to gear up, plan, make any arrangements they need to make within their facilities. What we looked at was the fact that about 85% to 90%, in fact, it's even higher now, it's about 90%+ of the cases, all the COVID active cases are currently in the southern four counties of New Hampshire, being Rockingham, Hillsborough, Stratford, and Merrimack County. That's where the vast majority of COVID is. For restaurants within those four counties, they can now open on June 15th at 50% indoor capacity. For restaurants existing in any of the other six counties where, fortunately, there's very few known COVID and active COVID cases, we're allowing them to open up at 100% capacity. So, you know, with these openings and our ability to flex open, we understand that not every business is really being able to be opened to its fullest. Many are not, frankly. There's a lot of restrictions in terms of capacity, whether you're talking about retail or restaurants or lodging, whatever it might be. We know there's still a lot of limitations out there. But with what we've done today, the assessment is that approximately 97-98% of businesses across the state, as of June 15th, will really have that flexibility to open in some fashion. We understand there are still a few industries and venues that are restricted. We've always talked about them as being some of the most challenging, things like movie theaters or large amusement parks that just typically bring in large amounts of folks and by the thousands sometimes, specifically from out of state. So we're working very hard to address those final venues and industries. We hope to have some guidance available for them soon. We appreciate everybody's patience in it. It is very tough.
Well, I imagine many people are looking forward to a more reopened New Hampshire. My hope is that we will ensure that there's sufficient testing capacity available so that as we live into a more relaxed set of guidelines, we can remain very aware of the return of an increase in infections. We're not out of the woods on this, and I think we need every tool possible to monitor how we're doing in this next phase. Let's hear a message from Sam Cook and return for a conversation with Jeannie Ruska from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire.
Just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
You are listening to State House Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee. In our Zoom studio again this week with Jeannie Ruska. Jeannie, what's your title at the ACLU?
Hi, Maggie. I'm the political director for the ACLU of New Hampshire.
All right, a big job to be sure. And we had you on as our guest earlier in the legislative session as you gave us an overview of some of the ACLU priorities. And now things have, not that your priorities have shifted, but the whole process has shifted quite a bit during the pandemic. Can you, before we dive into some of the issues I want to discuss today, can you just give us an update as to how you understand the legislative process will be completed this year?
We were all very concerned when the legislature kind of went into hibernation for a couple of months, and so are encouraged that we're now seeing both chambers reactivated. The House started meeting virtually in May, including holding committee executive sessions and voting on the remaining bills. But we've really seen the Senate pick up its activity in the last couple of weeks. June 30th is the de facto end of session. And so there's now this rush to wrap up all of this legislative work in a matter of weeks. And what we understand is that the Senate is working on a select number of really lengthy omnibus bills by topic. There's a child protection bill, there's going to be a transportation bill, presumably there'll be a healthcare bill, an education bill. And so the actual number of numerical bills that are going to be passed this session will be few, but each one of those will presumably have dozens of bills contained within them. And this is an effort to really expedite the process, including reducing the number of public hearings that are required. The Senate will hold public hearings on each omnibus bill, and these public hearings will be done virtually. People can participate through Zoom. And then when the Senate and the House are each scheduled to meet what looks like twice in person this month, the Senate will be passing all of those omnibus bills, and then the House will be concurring on them. And we think all of that can happen in the next 3 weeks. So there's a lot going on. But after March and April, when there really wasn't anything going on, it is encouraging to see the amount of legislating that is going to happen now in the next 3 weeks.
And these omnibus bills will only be comprised of existing pieces of legislation, or will new language be written as policy responses to this new moment that we're in?
That's an excellent question, and I think it'll be a combination of both. I think mostly it'll be existing bills, but obviously there's going to be some new content in response to COVID-19. One area where I know that's true, for instance, on healthcare, there's going to be presumably some COVID stuff. But I think some of the voting rights legislation, for instance, is going to be amended in response to the Secretary of State's task force and the recommendations that have come out of it. And responding to the fact that we're going to be holding elections in a year of COVID, when presumably we're all going to still be socially distancing, and there are going to be people who fear voting in person due to their health.
Right. I mean, I think our state primary is less than 100 days away, right? So we have to make sure that the policies are agreed on, the protocols, and that it's communicated clearly to people so they know how to engage in this really important process.
Exactly. And it has been encouraging to hear the governor say repeatedly, and the attorney general and the secretary of state, that people should not have to choose between their constitutional right to vote and their health.
Well, thank you for that overview. And good to see our elected officials engaging in and adapting to, you know, what is possible now so that this good work can get done. They are needed in this process. We don't want an executive only process as we negotiate all of this. Thanks for being with us today. The reason I specifically wanted to talk to you was because I know among ACLU's many priorities, you have dedicated attention to issues of criminal justice reform and police accountability. And those are certainly extremely relevant to the demands of millions of people who have been out in the streets now for 2 weeks, seeking to move forward in meaningful ways addressing the systemic racism that has led to the deaths of many innocent people, and primarily people of color and African Americans more specifically. So can you talk about what your activity is in terms of state legislative proposals? And then we'll talk a little bit about federal and local.
I think I join you and many others in just saying, in response to the tragic murder of George Floyd, it has been so inspiring to see the movement pick up across the country and globally. In calling for racial justice and police reform. In my lifetime, I've certainly never seen anything like this. And I think there is a big push at the local, state, national level to really seize upon it. So as you noted, for the ACLU, criminal justice reform and police reform have been longstanding priorities for our organization. But now is a time, we've never seen the amount of attention given to them that we're seeing right now. And so there's really a need to seize upon it. In terms of this legislative session, there are a couple dozen criminal justice reform related bills that we're moving through the legislative session. I hope to still see a couple of those taken up. The bill that everybody seems to be coalescing around is what's called HB 1217. which is a bill that we've supported from the get-go. We worked with the prime sponsor on it pre-session. And there's actually a similar bill introduced in the Senate, which is SB 470. And we also worked with the prime sponsor on that bill. And for both of these bills, the premise is to impose a mandatory reporting requirement on police to require that individual police officers report misconduct by other police officers. Mm-hmm. And this is really in response to a number of the videos we've seen where there is one officer committing the murder or the hostile act, but then there's other officers standing around watching. Wholly yeah. unacceptable. There has to be a requirement on police to report misconduct. Some of the mistrust within communities towards police is this sense that police protect police, right? Mm-hmm. Including police protecting bad police.
That's right.
And that has to be dealt with. And so both of these bills create this mandatory reporting requirement. And I just want to note, it's not a mandatory reporting requirement related to criminal prosecution. The reporting goes to the Police Standards and Training Commission, which is the body in charge of certifying police officers. Mm-hmm. So it goes to the question of whether a police officer should retain their certification if they are reportedly, if they have used excessive or illegal use of force or committed other criminal activity.
And this would be certification of state police as well as municipal police.
Correct. Any law enforcement officer in the state. And we've been making the analogy that lawyers have a mandatory reporting requirement by virtue of their law license. They have to report misconduct by fellow lawyers to the bar, and doctors have to report it to the Board of Medicine. And so in the criminal legal system, right, if you think of the four actors that most people come in contact with, a defense attorney, prosecutor, a judge, all three of those have law degrees and are under a mandatory reporting requirement, right? Mm-hmm. The most central actor in the criminal legal system that doesn't currently have a mandatory reporting requirement are police. Wow. And yet they are the ones that are being caught on video, doing these just egregious acts of excessive use of force. And so that HB 1217 was obviously written and enacted before all of this. But what's encouraging is it was actually sailing through the legislature before this movement. It passed out of House Criminal Justice and Public Safety 18-0.
Wow.
And it passed the New Hampshire House on voice vote.
Wow.
And this, this was back in March before any of this had happened.
I assume at the time it was with the opposition of police.
Yes, it has been opposed by police. And we had concerns about whether it would be able to get through the New Hampshire Senate, which has tended to be a little more hostile to criminal justice reform and certainly to police reform. Mm-hmm. And so it's been encouraging to see this bill really championed now by New Hampshire legislators as a priority. We do expect that it will be included in one of the omnibus bills that is going forward. We've heard from both Republican sponsors of HB 1217 as well as the Republican sponsor of SB 470 that they're really optimistic about their caucuses supporting this legislation. My sense is that it's being kind of universally supported in the Senate right now. I mean, obviously that could change, but that's encouraging. It means legislators are hearing the people who are speaking up right now and feel an obligation to respond.
Very good. Well, and it probably wouldn't hurt to invite our listeners and others to let their senators know that they want to see support for this provision.
Absolutely. We've been encouraging ACLU voters to do the same. Now is the time to call your senator, right? Every single New Hampshire legislator is up for re-election this year. They are very mindful of what their constituents want right now. And so if you want to have, power as a voter this close to an election, you have the most power you will have. And so people should absolutely be calling their state senator and urging them to support HB 1217 or whatever omnibus bill ends up containing HB 1217.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN-LP 94.7 FM in Concord, streaming at WNHNFM.org. Let's return to Maggie Fogarty's interview with Jeannie Hruska from the New Hampshire ACLU.
I know you're paying attention to another, seems like a common sense proposal that Representative Cushing has led the way on that would it provide reimbursement for psychological assessment? Say something about that.
Yeah, so this is, it's a reimbursement bill, as you noted. In theory, police departments should be doing psychological screenings of police officers, particularly of new police officers. And there's some concern that that screening may not be done or may not be as thoroughly done as it could be because of a lack of resources. Mm-hmm. And so what Representative Cushing's bill would do is reimburse localities for the cost of those screenings. Really with the goal of incentivizing that those screenings happen.
And again,
we've heard from police chiefs and police departments, right, that this is important, that police officers experience trauma. They experience the same sort of mental health issues that the general population does. And so it's really important that they have, that they be screened, and obviously then that resources be available. I think what we're really seeing is the importance of mental health treatment across the board.
Very good. And that's a very important point you're making. So often police are called to respond to scenarios in which our other systems are failing, either through insufficient investment of funds or overwhelming, crisis. But when they respond to homelessness, when they respond to acute untreated mental illness or the consequences of substance misuse, they're absorbing whether it's grief or anger or frustration or a sense of impotence in the face of these failed systems, I don't know what else to call it, that require our attention and our investment. So that does take a toll.
One thing I just want to note here, because this has been part of this conversation in response to these protests, you've heard the phrase defund the police. And I think really what we're talking about is divesting from the police, because what people are trying to prioritize really is prioritizing resources into community services, right? Yeah. It's not just pulling money from the police because that's the goal. The goal is to make sure that resources are actually going towards the services that most contribute to public well-being and public health. And since
safety.
The 1980s, we know is that spending on law enforcement in our criminal legal system has dramatically outpaced spending on community services such as housing and education. And so the question, particularly in response to COVID, when we know towns and state budgets are being decimated, is there going to be a spotlight on localities to say, how are you spending what limited resources you have? And should that money be going to the police department, or should it be going to public housing and mental health treatment, as we were just talking about, or substance use treatment? There are so many community services that when insufficiently funded, the problems that stem from that end up getting quote unquote taken care of by police, even though they're not policing issues, they're public welfare issues.
That's right. You're absolutely right. That divest invest frame is very helpful across the board for all of the ways that we invest in policing, violence, militarism. And so hopefully people are building our fluency to make demands for what does make for safer, healthier communities.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is policing to some extent is a last resort, right? Police come in when every other system has failed. When the education system has failed, when housing has failed, when the public health system has failed, then police come in. And I think what we've seen is, given the expansion in policing, is just how decimated our public services have been and the consequences of that. And so there really does need to be a close analysis as to where state funding is going and a reinvestment in those community services that actually enable people to be safe, to be well, to be able to operate and function in their communities.
Do you want to comment on the developments from Minneapolis over the weekend, where community members appear to be insisting on and convincing the council to bring this divest invest frame to their you know, police budget debates.
Yeah, I really commend the Minneapolis City Council for responding so quickly to the calls of their community. We've seen this done elsewhere. I believe in Camden, New Jersey, something similar was done where you dismantled the police department. And the real catch here, obviously, is it's great to hear them say that, but what does that look like, right? You dismantle the police department and then do what? So again, I think it's great that they have made this commitment. And I fully believe that the people of Minneapolis and Minnesota will ensure that they follow through with that and take the necessary action that whatever ends up replacing the police department is systemically different than what they're trying to dismantle. And so I think it's encouraging, and I hope that other states and localities follow suit. Even if it's not wholly dismantling the police department, recognizing that this is a chance to really reevaluate the role of police.
That's right.
And to figure out if the role that police are currently serving is actually beneficial. Is it actually producing the results that we think it is, right? Is that money being well spent? So I hope this really encourages a conversation in city councils within mayor's offices about what communities need.
Yes, amen. And so now would be the time for New Hampshire people to, I mean, municipal budget decisions might get made on a variety of timelines, some with town meeting, others, you know, cities on a different calendar. But now is certainly the time to let our local elected officials know that we want to do things differently. We want a safer, stronger community, which means investing differently.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what people really need to understand is a lot of police reform is local. Police departments are local entities. They respond to city councils, they respond to mayors. And so when you talk about changing use of force policies, when you talk about civilian review boards, when you talk about police budgets, that's all local.
Local.
So when people say, you know, what can I do? The answer is, do you know who your city council person is? Do you know who your city alderman is? Do you know your mayor? Like,
speak to your school board. The police presence in our high schools and middle schools and elementary schools is another place that we
absolutely. And a good question is, you know, what if we contemplated replacing police officers in schools with school counselors, with social workers, right? And so, absolutely, think local. We know, for instance, that Manchester, the biggest town in New Hampshire, is finalizing its budget right now. And the current proposal would fund 10 additional police positions. So, you know, the people of Manchester who are watching these protests and marches and saying, what can I do? Talk to your city officials. Figure out if that's how you want your city tax money spent.
Right. That's your money. And those are your schools.
Absolutely.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP 94.7 FM in Concord, streaming at WNHNFM.org. Let's return to Maggie Fogarty's interview with Jeannie Hruska from the New Hampshire ACLU.
Well, so let's stay on schools for just a second, because there was another ACLU priority this year that addresses a disproportionate impact of certain kinds of disciplinary actions in school. That is absolutely relevant to this broader national conversation about racial justice. What's the status of that bill?
It is. So we're a part of a group called the Juvenile Rights Project, along with the Disability Rights Center, Waypoint, New Hampshire Legal Assistance, and New Futures. And as a group, we have been prioritizing student discipline reform. Because what we know in New Hampshire, based on New Hampshire data, is that there are two types of students who are disproportionately subjected to exclusionary discipline in our schools, and that is students of color and students with disabilities. And what data shows is this is pretty uniform across the state. It's not just one school district. This is a problem across New Hampshire. And so our group has been supporting legislation now for 2 years to really relook at how exclusionary discipline is used and to make sure that exclusionary discipline, meaning suspensions and expulsions, are not used as a first resort. that all efforts are made to really keep kids in the classroom. We know that a single suspension impacts a student's long-term education. It impacts their well-being. It makes it more likely they enter the criminal legal system. And what we're concerned about right now in the time of COVID is obviously kids have been under extreme stress over the last few months and have had to experience schooling from home. And so gaps in education and differences in learning have been exacerbated, right? I mean, we know that some kids are not going to have learned as effectively from home as others. We just know that.
And that's so right. And often lack the tools, even the technology tools.
Yeah, including don't have internet, for instance. That's a pretty fundamental issue when you're talking about virtual education. And so we have a lot of concerns that when kids go back to the classroom in the fall, that those gaps in learning will create challenges and that those challenges will be met with an increase in exclusionary discipline. And that's concerning because, again, exclusionary discipline is actually really harmful for students. And so we're optimistic that this legislation will get taken up in one of the omnibus bills. The student discipline reform effort. Again, I think in response to the movement right now, but also in response to COVID, that when we talk to legislators, they understand this connection, that this is actually COVID relevant.
That's right. They have to be hearing from teachers who are heartbroken. And I know from the teachers in my life were very anxious for many weeks about the students that they simply were not hearing from. And they knew that there were simply so many obstacles to their participating in this new online way. So, well, very good. Thank you for making sure that still has a chance for this year as part of the larger effort for educational equity. Let's take a few minutes and talk about what needs to be done at the federal level. I mean, certainly you're making an excellent point that so much about policing happens in a very local way and at the state level. But what do you recommend to advocates who also want our members of Congress to act in a certain way?
There's absolutely a role for the federal government. I think we've seen that in the last week or two with U.S. senators and congresspeople laying out what they intend to do in terms of legislation. I know the Speaker of the House has said they intend to see comprehensive police reform legislation put forward by the end of the month. And so there is going to be legislation taken up. Some of the issues that legislators are looking at are ending the militarization of the police, ending the transfer of excess military equipment from the federal government to local police departments, which is critically important. Sure. We know if you give police departments military equipment, they will use it. Military equipment is designed to defeat an enemy. It is not designed to protect communities. And so that's important. There's legislation about ending qualified immunity.
Say what that is.
So qualified immunity is what protects police officers from being held individually accountable when they violate somebody's civil rights. You know, when you can't sue a police officer, you end up suing a police department. And if a settlement is made, it's actually the police department or often an insurance company that ends up paying it. It's not the individual officer. And so the goal really is to make sure that individual police officers who commit these egregious acts of violence against Black people can be held individually accountable. Because part of that, I mean, if you know that you won't be held individually accountable, imagine how that changes your behavior. So that's certainly one of the issues that's going to get taken up. And then I think there's going to be conversations about the use of specific tactics, right? Should tear gas be used? If so, when? I think it's going to be much more regulated. At least I hope it does. So we're going to see this conversation. And again, I say this over and over again, but contact your representative. Contact Senator Shaheen, Senator Hassan, Congressman Pappas and Congresswoman Custer, tell them to prioritize these issues. And it's not just, you know, vote for this when it comes up. It's urging our senators and our representatives to publicly call for this legislation.
Yes, to be champions.
On the record supporting it. Not enough to, you know, have a silent vote once the bill hits the floor. We need to hear our elected officials speak up on these issues and make clear what they intend to prioritize in response to these protests.
And there are all sorts of ways to do that, certainly email, phone calls, but these regular COVID-19 briefings that they seem to be having quite regularly would also be opportunities to submit these questions and
absolutely
invite their response. Well, Jeannie Ruska, you're doing amazing work, and it's going to be a wild next couple of weeks, so I'll be happy to let you go get back to that, but it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and thank you again. We'll see you at the Whittemore Center, perhaps, on the 11th.
Thank you, Maggie.
Yeah.
And thank you for AFSC's work on Saturday at the Concord March. It was really just an incredible event.
Well, it was an honor to support these young leaders. We got a long way to go together, but
absolutely,
I feel hopeful.
I'm inspired by their leadership.
Amen.
You've been listening to State House Watch Radio with me, Arnie Alpert, and my co-host, Maggie Fogarty, on WNHN-LP. Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all our past shows, as well as The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, and Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. Join us again next week, and remember, there's a bright side somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. And there's more love somewhere. And there's more peace somewhere. I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. People got a good job somewhere. Got a lot of good friends somewhere. Got a little suitcase. Got a little family. Over on the bright side.